It's Wrecking Ball Radio.
Shut up and entertain me.
There's no rules. There's no rules.
Holy sh! It's amazing.
I see her sarcasm and nastiness grow.
This is Davin's Den.
Everybody, you are listening to Davin's Den. Yes, Davin's Den, the show that is better than classic Christmas entertainment. You could join our chat room, the Den Pen, by going to davinsden.com and clicking on air. Although, to be honest, I'm not really there to monitor it right now. I'll explain that in a second. I am your host, Davin Rosenblatt. I'm joined by comedian Kevin Lee.
I'm glad to be back, Davin.
Glad to have you, Kev.
Glad to be back.
And on the phone, my pal, Mr. John Patterson Jr. How are you, John?
Hey, what's up, Davin? Kevin, how we doing?
Hey, John, good to hear you again, man.
So, Pip
Hewitt. Good to hear you, brother.
Pip and Joe, not here, as you guys can tell. Pip may be calling in later. She was under the weather, and Joe is out tonight. So I have a little gathering of all-stars to do this. So on the show, we got Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer may be sexist and bigoted. Baby, It's Cold Outside might be a bit too rapey. We got a whole lot of turbulent air to discuss. And, you know, if Pip gets here, we're going to do Bitches Be Crazy, and we're going to play Dead or Alive. But I want to start off with I was sad by it. It's hard to be sad when a 94-year-old man who's led a great life passes away.
But
George Bush Sr. passed away. It's sad.
It is sad. And I think because we're losing you know, we're losing the era, man. We're losing
guy's a patriot.
Yeah, we're losing that whole the dynasty thing.
I don't mind the dynasty. Listen, I didn't like the dynasty.
You didn't like the dynasty?
No, and for my money, the dynasty left with George Bush Sr. I like George Bush Sr. His son, a lot I don't like. Yeah. But George Bush Sr., the man was public service, a patriot, just a classy guy. You know,
he was the head of the CIA. He has some blood on his hands. Come on, man. I mean, I'm sad about his passing.
But head of the CIA, you also have to realize he probably did a lot of stuff to protect us that we don't even know about.
That's probably true. Yes.
I mean, you know, and we know he was the youngest fighter pilot. We know he strengthened the EPA. He signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. We know he signed the Montreal Protocol, which is according to NASA.
He also gave us Clarence Thomas.
Hey, listen, the Senate had to approve it.
Yeah.
You know, and listen, Biden was not clean on that either.
Okay.
You know, listen.
We pull up Biden's record soon, trust me, because he's going to run.
Yeah, well, unfortunately.
That's another story.
Listen, it's probably very rare these days for me to wax poetically
yes.
about a conservative, although I did about John McCain.
And so did I. Yeah. I mean, you know, and as I put on Facebook yesterday, somebody was dogging out. Dogging the President Bush who passed, and I was like, "This is ridiculous to, you know, to beat up on this guy in the week of his passing."
Listen, nobody is perfect. You kind of said he's got blood on his hands. Listen, he did things that people don't like. Every president did. I liked Obama a lot. There were things that I could point to that I didn't agree with.
And
that's
fine.
I'm with
you on that one. Yes,
that's fine. And I've said it many times on this show. For my money in my lifetime, I really don't remember Jimmy Carter. So I can really remember from Reagan on. In my lifetime, there
Jimmy Carter doesn't remember Jimmy Carter.
Now he's still with it. Jimmy's doing well. For my money, in my lifetime, if I go from Reagan forward, there have been two American presidents that have not embarrassed the nation. Whether you agree with their politics or not, for my money, it has been George Bush Sr.
Okay.
and Barack Obama. Those have been the two guys that have held the office with dignity and class. Whether you agree with their decisions.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I think as time goes on, and we're starting to see it now, Bush Sr.'s presidency is going to look better and better as time goes on. The man accomplished a lot of things. You know, here's the problem. A guy like Bush could not even win a primary today in the GOP. He'd probably have to run as a Democrat, to be honest with you. But that's just where the country has moved to. Because this guy, I mean, I remember in 1980 they showed an interview with him. They're like, are you strong enough? And they're like, well, if you talk about not bullying and having character, then yes, I'm strong enough. The guy wasn't a blowhard. The guy was the real deal.
Yes, he was. And that's weird that you can't be nice anymore.
Well, you can be nice. Well, no. But people take it as weakness now. Yes. And here's another thing I liked about Bush. And John, jump in here with your feelings about him before we get to your story. But here's another thing that I liked about him. The guy wanted to know stuff. He knew he didn't know everything. So he surrounded himself with smart people. He read voraciously. He wanted to know what was going on so he could be a better person and do the best job. I like those qualities in a human being. I'm sorry.
I'm no fan of Dick Cheney, but anyway, yeah.
Cheney was good under senior. It went to shit under junior.
Yeah, yes. That is probably true, too, yeah.
I mean, a lot of things went to shit under junior. I don't want to get into W, the junior today.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the guy was a voracious reader. He surrounded himself with very intelligent people. If you look at the way they handled the breaking up of the Soviet Union, if you look at the way they went into Iraq and formed that coalition, and it didn't wind up costing us anything, the guy knew what he was doing. So, I mean, listen, I don't want to make this so much shitting on President Trump, because I could do that all night, and I don't really want to do that. But I do look at what we had.
It's funny, I bit my tongue three times since we started this conversation.
I know. But I look at what we had, and I look at the passing of Senior, and I look at the passing of McCain, and I long for that. I think we're going to get back to that, though, because we have a lot of veterans that were just elected to office and that have been elected recently from our latest wars. And I not that you have to be a veteran to be president of the United States or to serve your country, but I think it helps. I think people in the military will tell you there's not Republicans, there's not Democrats. We just have a mission, and we have to get the job done. And I think it's better for our country when we get to that mindset, as opposed to this is my team and I have to beat your team, and wherever the country comes in is a distant second.
Well, you know, you brought up a really good point there, Devin, when you're talking about presidents that were military members and members of service as opposed to that aren't. And, you know, one thing that you know as well as I do with, you know, members of services, it's very disciplined and very regimented. And when you're out in the battlefield, you know, those guys and gals that are next to you, they're your family. You know, you're depending on them to take you home just as much as they're depending on you to get them home.
Absolutely.
And if you look back on the presidencies and as you're talking about, you know, take a look at President Bush. You know, he's a war hero. You know, he entered the Navy at the age of 18, was a naval pilot, got shot down, survived in the ocean, was rescued by a ship.
I'm going to push back on that in just one little bit, though, because and I agree with you that it is a great way to become a leader. I think that's what you're getting at, what you have to do, right, and the loyalty.
Well, absolutely. You know, it's dedication to country. I mean, who else is going to be dedicated to the country more than
I would say, and I know you weren't a fan of Obama, but I would say Obama was a community leader. So that was service. Then, you know, so he did service, and that's why he had such a loyal group of people around. If you look at Obama and you look at Bush Sr., there wasn't a lot of backbiting and scandal within those administrations, whereas if you went to Reagan and W and, of course, what we're dealing with now, a whole lot of scandal in the administration. So though I agree with you 100%, John, that going the military route is a great way to be a leader, I don't think it's the only way.
No, it's not the only way.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I was just taking what you were talking about over the last 25, 30 years of presidencies and looking at, you know, what we've had and what we have, and it's night and day.
Oh God,
and
yes.
I think society as a whole has also changed over the last 30 years. You know, mm-hmm. Kevin, you brought up a really good point before when you talked about, you know, with President Bush passing, it's like the end of an era, and you know, it is okay to be upset because you know, America as we knew it, that wholesome, you know, help your fellow man, it's gone. You know, I mean, look what we got now.
It's definitely gone.
Fighting in the streets and people, you know, hitting each other because they don't like that, you know, you're saying, baby, it's cold outside. Like, are we serious? Like,
well, I'm going to push back on that, too, because you know what? No, because there are good people. I know you're doing I know you're working on a fundraising event that's coming up, and lots of people do good things.
Oh, we just did it.
Oh, that you just did. See? So, yeah. So, I mean, there's still people doing good things. We're just inundated with this black cloud of dread.
Yeah.
And the loudest voices getting all the attention. There are still good people doing things, and I just hope that they get to rise up the ranks and come to power, and that the rest of us can follow that lead and not long for the days of a big blowhard, you know, whoever shouts the loudest is the toughest man in the room. Because to me, that was never tough.
Well, as long as there's social media, we're never going to get back to where we were.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. And that's, you know, you bring up that point. I heard something earlier today which was mind-blowing. You know the saying, bringing home the bacon? You know that saying, bring home the
bacon? I don't because I'm Jewish, so could you make it roast beef?
Okay. Well, now they're saying that it's offensive and it needs to be outlawed because it offends people that are vegan.
What?
And people that are Muslims. Yeah, true story. It's all over the news.
Wait. By all over the news, is all over Fox News or is that all over the place?
Oh, wow. I haven't heard that.
No, I saw it posted on Facebook by like four or five different news organizations, like legitimate news organizations.
I don't want to get into this too much now, because I will later. But this is a reason why people hate liberals. Pick your battles. Pick your damn battles. There are so many things that liberals should be genuinely upset about and in the streets and complaining about. A phrase like bring home the bacon is not one of them. Shut the fuck up. So you bring home the tofu. What is wrong with you people?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Well, that's better than bringing home the lettuce right now. So
yes, do not bring home the romaine. Nobody bring home the romaine.
Well, you know, me being a chubby guy, you know, I'm really excited about this time period right now that lettuce is bad and cake is actually healthier for you. It's what I've been trying to campaign with for the past 15 years.
Listen,
now it's finally come to fruition.
I talk frequently on this show about my love of cake. I think you and I can bring left and right together, and you and I should run on a platform of cake. I don't know if we should run for anything, but like I just like to have us standing on cake and then eating the ground. So we should run on a platform of cake.
And I'm a guy sitting here who does
some
like
people
three
run on
kale salads.
I run on Twinkies and Ring Dings.
You don't run
to go,
but you don't.
I do if there's a Twinkie and Ring Ding involved.
Good man. Yeah, Kev's Mr. Health fanatic over here.
Yes, I had a smoothie before I came here.
Kale smoothie?
Yes.
Get the fuck out.
No, kale smoothie with pineapples inside.
Sounds terrible. It sounds terrible.
It's very delicious, actually.
Sounds terrible.
It's good for your arteries.
Although they do say pineapples make your sperm taste better, so that is good.
Well, I'll let you know. Well, not you.
Don't let me know.
No, I'll let you know.
Listen.
Well, this conversation took a turn.
That most certainly has. We were talking about our deceased president, and now we're talking
about sperm tasting. Well, Davin brought that up.
I did bring that up. I apologize, and I did not mean to...
That's
smart.
A conversation we were talking about Bill Clinton. Come on now.
Oh, hey now.
You know, that would work, actually.
You know, listen, that just shows you how much we've changed as a nation. Bill Clinton was hailed as a great guy, and now the Democrats don't want anything to do with him. And I don't blame him.
Yep.
See, I disagree with that. Well, I mean, you're right. They don't want anything to do with him, but he wasn't a bad president.
No, he was fine until he lied.
Okay.
He was fine until he lied. Well, now we're used to lying.
The president now lies, and they love him.
And I don't like that guy at all.
Okay.
I'm very consistent.
Well, he lied about cheating on his wife.
But
this
he
guy
lied under oath.
Yes.
That's the problem. Don't lie under oath. All he had to say, and I've talked about this before, all he had to say is, listen, this is a personal matter between me and my wife. That's all he had to say, and America would have gone, okay, that's fine. And he still left a very popular president. But the thing is now, you look at that and you look at all the other allegations against him, all the rape allegations, the sexual assault allegations against Bill Clinton, where we just kind of pushed them to the side like we didn't give those women credibility. And now you go, mm-hmm. You know what? Maybe we should have listened. But
yeah.
it's completely partisan because the left did it for Clinton back in the day and the right has done it for Donald Trump right now. So people don't want to look what's right in front of them if it hurts their guy.
So Bush Sr. didn't have any controversies in his...
Well, it came out a few years ago, and this is when he was wheelchair bound, that he grabbed a couple of women in the ass. Well, I don't know. I mean, listen.
Oh, yeah, during the All-Star game.
But this was after he was president. This is an old man in a wheelchair. I'm not doing his presidency.
Were there scandals during the Willie Horton ad when he ran for president? That was a racist ad.
Yes, that was a racist ad. And you know, I was going to bring that up, actually.
Well, right. No, but listen, nobody's perfect. Nobody, and that was certainly a blemish on his record.
Yes.
But like I said, Obama did things we didn't like. Also, he didn't run a racist ad. But
no, he didn't run.
But I think you take the overall picture. So like you could take the overall picture of Bill Clinton and say he was a good president. I'm just telling you right now, the left wants nothing to do with him.
Well, that's because they're a bunch of
you can say whatever you want.
They're a bunch of pussies. That's what I'm.
Well, listen. I mean,
look, we just had. Getting off subject, two elections stolen from us. I believe the Florida election was stolen. The Georgia election definitely was stolen from.
But you see what's going on in North Carolina.
So I mean,
the North Carolina, there actually is voter fraud right now. They're not confirming the election of a Congress seat because apparently the Republicans were doing some shit. They were like burning ballots. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
I think the election in Georgia was stolen from Abrams. That's just, you know.
Listen, I mean, we talked about this on the show. The fact that the Attorney General – no, was it Attorney General? No, yeah. Not Attorney General.
No, not Attorney General.
The guy who's in charge of the elections is the guy that ran for governor.
Exactly.
So he oversaw his own election.
Yes.
Even if he didn't do anything, it looks bad. But I want to get back – you know, because you got to recuse yourself. Go, listen, I can't oversee my own election. But there's no law. But back to Bush Sr., a lot of people probably be surprised to hear me waxing poetic about a conservative, but I do think he was a good president. I certainly would have taken two terms of his instead of two terms of his son. You know,
oh, his son got dealt a bad deal too. I mean, 9/11 happened on his watch,
which he was warned about.
Which
he was warned about.
Yeah, I'm sure he was. Yeah.
No, he was warned.
He was warned about it.
Okay. He was warned about it. But I'll even let that slide. I don't want to get into W's mayhem. But Afghanistan, you know, right after 9/11, he was tremendous. W was tremendous. The Iraq War is a problem.
That was a major problem.
The Iraq War was a problem, and his handling of Hurricane Katrina
was
a problem.
Yes.
I just didn't agree with Kanye that he hated black people, but I just think he was inept. But
yeah.
I don't want to get into the side. But anyway, but John, you have a really – I want to close the segment on a senior. You have a really nice story about an interaction you had with him when you were a young boy.
Yeah, so President Bush, may God bless his soul, was probably – one of the most, and you'll hear it more stories come out. I heard one on the news record went on the air. He was very, very dedicated to his country, to his fellow man, to his family. Friends of mine are personal friends of his. People that I've worked with are personal friends of their family, and everyone has the same comments about him. But when I was a young boy, about 5-6 years old, I was a very big fan of George Bush, and still am to this day. I think he's probably one of the best presidents that's ever run the country, and just an overall good person. So when I was like 5 or 6 and I was in grammar school, I was the campaign manager in my school for electing George Bush because we were learning about democracy and the election system and things like that. So I got a chance to go to D.C. with my family. And I thought it would be fun to make President Bush a gift because I'm 5. What the hell do I know? So I made. Do you remember the old-fashioned sun catchers that you used to be able to buy in like the different craft stores? It was called Make It Bake It, and you put the crystals in the little frame, and then you put it in the oven for a few minutes, and it would make like a stained glass window. Do you remember those?
Yeah, I remember
those.
When
you were younger?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so we found one, and it was. One of the United States, and it said USA in the center, and on the state of Texas with a gold star. So I made with my mom to give to President Bush this little stained glass window. And when we went to D.C. for Easter vacation, we found out the post office that services the White House. So I wrapped it up, brought it to the post office, and I said I wanted to give it to the president. So the Secret Service agent, very nice, but very matter of fact, said, well, we're going to open it up before we bring it to President Bush. So my mom had opened up the box, show him what it was, and they said, okay, you know, looks like a nice present. We'll make sure the president gets it. And with that, we watched him give it to the mailman, who was another Secret Service agent, and we watched it get wheeled over to the White House. And I put a little note with it, things like that. About 2 weeks later, I get a letter from President Bush saying, you know, dear young supporter, you know, thank you for your kind gesture, you know, may God bless you kind of deal. You know, President Bush. I was ecstatic. I was like, wow, this is great. I got a letter from the president. A few days later, I get another envelope from the White House. I open it up, and it was a handwritten letter from President Bush himself. And he wrote, "Dear Johnny," because that's how I signed my letter, "thank you so much for the beautiful sun catcher that you made for me. I showed Barbara. We hung it in the Oval Office so I can look at it every day and I can think of you. Thank you so much for running my campaign," and he named the school that I went to. "It's good to know that I've got people on the ground as young as you supporting me in the White House. If you're ever in Washington again, you know, please come by and say hi to me. Your friend, President George W. Bush." And then he wrote, "P.S., I've included a present for you." And he autographed a picture for me, signed by the president. I just thought that was pretty awesome. And my parents were like, "Oh, that's great." Well, a few weeks later, President Bush gave an address to the nation from the Oval Office. And sure enough, right behind the chair in the Oval Office was the sun catcher that I made him. So he was telling the truth. He really did hanging up in the Oval Office. I've since found out, after putting my condolences up on Facebook, on George W.'s Facebook page, and so many people have responded. I got like over 35,000 likes just on the comment. People that were connected to President Bush were seeing that, and they passed along to other people. And there's people that work for the museum of George Bush, and they said that it's pretty cool to see the stories when you look at the inventory and you realize where they came from. So I reached out to those people, and I asked them if it really was in the museum, and one of the employees got back to me, and they said it more than likely is, unless he took it home with him, because when you give a president a present, when they leave the White House, it's considered a gift to the people. Mm-hmm. So everything goes into one of two places. It'll either go into the National Museum of History, where all the president's artifacts go, or in that case, it would go to George Bush's museum, because he had one made for him as well. They said, so it's very possible. They said, give it a few days after everything, you know, kind of settles with the funeral that's going to be happening there. But reach out to them, tell them what it is, give them your name. They can actually locate it, and they can take a picture for me. It's in the museum. And the only way it wouldn't be in the museum is if it's still in his house in Texas.
Oh, wow.
So thought that was pretty cool.
That's
that
cool.
President Bush took the time to write a letter to thank a five-year-old little boy for making a gift for him. I still have it to this day. It's the coolest thing in the world, and I couldn't be more honored to have something like that. And, you know, people need to know that, because people see a president and they think that they don't care, and Bush was the exact opposite. He cared about everyone. And I heard another thing last night on the news that said people were talking about Bush, and they said he was the type of guy that wrote a thank you note for everything. So that just validates exactly what I'm saying, because no matter who I've talked to, and, you know, Bush's family, or, you know, talk to you that's worked for President Bush, they all said the same thing. There's like, there's not a doubt in my mind that that's not true, because that's just the kind of guy he was. And I just think that's kind of awesome to have a little piece of history, you know, from a president that was so damn good and is no longer with us.
I think it's a great story. I think it's a nice testament to the man, a nice testament to you to remember all that and share that. We appreciate that, bud. I know you got to run off and host some trivia tonight, so we won't keep you too long, but I certainly appreciate you sharing that lovely story about our former president.
It's an awesome president.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you bringing me on the show, and you know, I hope you go wreak some more havoc.
I most certainly will. I'll talk to you later. Take care, pal.
Press. All right. Bye.
Take care.
That's a great story.
That was a good story.
And I have heard, you know, in the days that he was very good to children. I also heard he stopped signing autographs.
Why?
I don't know why. I guess it just got too much or whatever. But so that's kind of cool.
Could be because his handwriting sucked, maybe. His handwriting sucked?
I don't know. I don't know. I unfortunately do not have anything signed by the president. But I did not send
any
the president.
Any president?
By any president. I have nothing signed.
I've never met a president. I would love to meet a president.
No, well, I wouldn't. See, we've talked about this. I don't think I would meet this president.
No, I wouldn't meet this president. Nobody wants to meet this president.
No, but I mean, you know, a lot of athletes. But I like Kevin, you get asked to perform at the White House for President Trump. What are you doing?
Me, knowing me, I would turn it down.
I think I would turn it down, too.
I would turn it down because... you know, I would turn it down. And it would hurt me to turn it down, because a chance to perform at the White House is something that's supposed to be, you know. But I would turn it down.
Yeah, I think I would, too.
I mean, the money would be tempting, but I would turn it down. You know, I can't think of the name of the singer who actually performed there, and she got a lot of backlash, and it actually hurt her career.
Well, that's what it is. Now it's gotten crazy.
She's paid well, by the way.
You show up to the White House, now there's like a backlash against you.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if that's really fair either. People got to make their own decision. You don't have to hate somebody.
People got to make a living, too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just don't have anything to say to this guy. Nothing positive. I have nothing positive.
Well, if he wins again.
Oh, God, no.
I was just thinking about his inaugural ball, the people performing there. It'd be absolutely nobody.
No, that's not true. You'll have Nugent. You'll have Kid Rock.
Oh,
you'll have Sarah Palin telling jokes, or as she calls it, giving a speech.
Okay.
I mean, no. I mean, you'll have Tim Allen, I guess. I mean, there'll be people. There's always people. But I don't want to get into too much Trump. I feel like, unless you want to.
No, I don't. I'm in a good mood.
I'm just.
No.
Here's where we are.
Well, how can you not talk about Trump?
Here's where we are with this president. The fact that he hasn't acted like an asshole to the Bush family this week and has actually acted in a traditional way, we're praising him.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because he was invited to.
Right.
The funeral.
Right.
If they're not letting him speak, though. Well, senior, because I mean, you expect him to get up there in front of the world and say something.
But it's traditional where the sitting president would give one of the eulogies. That's traditional. They're not letting him speak.
Now, is Obama giving a eulogy?
No, I don't think
so. I don't think so either.
But Obama will be there.
I would love to see
Obama. But you
Obama
also have to remember.
And watch Trump's face.
But you have to remember. We'll see how they're all sitting together. But you have to remember Michelle Obama and George H.W. Bush's son, have grown very close.
Yes.
So you're going to see them there, and Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush grew very close.
Yes.
So you're going to see that, and that's a tribute to all the people involved looking past all the partisan nonsense that so many people get hung up on, and looking at the humanity, which we don't have going on right now.
So what we saw at the McCain funeral is that humanity.
Because at some point you have to realize greatness.
Yes.
You have to realize that, hey, I don't agree with how this person did things, but I believe in their heart they did the best they could for the nation.
Yes.
And if you can do that, you can make peace with their decisions.
Yes, and I believe McCain did that. And he,
I think the Sarah Palin thing, I think that's where politics got involved. I think he wanted Joe Lieberman. To be his vice president, and he was told he can't have it, and I'm sure he regrets not having Joe Lieberman. If you look back, if I'm going to lose, at least I'm losing with one of my best friends.
Well, he should have stuck to his guns and did.
Palin gave him a bump initially, but then Palin being Palin flamed out. You got to remember, Obama gave George H.W. Bush the Presidential Medal of Honor in 2011 for what he's done. For the country. I mean, that's the highest honor you can give a civilian.
Well, 45 is getting praised now for bending over backwards, you know, sending a plane out to get...
That's what he's supposed to
do. And they're praising him for it. That's what killed him.
Being decent is now, he's being decent
and he's getting praised for doing what he's supposed to do, and that's be decent. It's really a strange times we're living in.
it's weird. It's weird how the same party who elected George H.W. Bush also elected Donald Trump. It's really weird
it's the same party, but not the same people. I mean,
no, some of the same people who voted for George H.W. Bush are still alive. They voted for President Trump. Still alive. Most of the people that voted for Trump voted for H.W. Bush because they're old as fuck.
Yes,
It's the same people. It's the same party. But you had 1,000 points of light. What can we do to service our community, make our country better, make the world better? 1,000 points of light, George H.W. Bush, too. What can we do to make me better, Donald Trump? It blows my mind.
Oh, my God. It's the most amazing thing that's going on right now. I can't even. We don't want to get into Trump.
No, I don't want to get into Trump. But I do. I am saddened to see what, in my mind, is a great American pass away. And I hope over time his presidency is looked upon a little bit more positively.
Well, I think he's overshadowed, of course, because he
is it between Reagan and Clinton.
Yes,
I mean, you know,
I mean, one guy, Reagan, who to the Republicans is God.
Until Trump.
And yeah,
no, seriously, he was the gold standard until what we're seeing now.
I don't think Trump has replaced Reagan.
You can't be a Reagan Republican and be a Trump
That's what I'm saying. I don't think those people are on board. They may have voted, but I don't think they're on board anymore.
Well, there's not enough of them saying anything. Some are. I mean, Reagan, who, you know, listen, as a kid, I liked him, but what did I know? Yeah. Looking back now, not so much a fan. But he did do certain things well. He was great with Gorbachev. You know, he held firm and everything. You know, a lesser man might have crumbled. There might have been a nuclear war. He did great with that. So we had somebody who was strong in the face of a real enemy, where nuclear war was really a possibility, versus somebody who gets up there and fellates him, fellates the Russian KGB leader.
I'm going to tell you the interesting thing is going to be at this funeral is Jeb Bush interaction with Trump.
Listen,
those
staying,
two.
I think they're going to shake it. Listen, I don't think you're going to see anything publicly weird because I don't think the Bushes are that way, and Trump won't be triggered to be an ass.
He can't help be an ass.
But there's so many places.
How long can he fake it?
Well, he's still being an ass. He just won't aim it at Bush. He's still spouting off and doing his nonsense, but he won't aim it at the Bush family. Which, God, please don't let these people grieve. Let these people say goodbye to their father, their grandfather.
He didn't let McCain's family grieve.
No, but he was triggered because he wasn't invited and because he had a direct interaction with McCain because McCain didn't give him the vote he wanted on health care.
Gotcha.
So he's very bitter about that. So I don't think the Bushes – I mean the Bushes –
Well, he has a feud with the Bush, one Jed.
I don't think the mom
didn't even want him at the funeral.
I don't think they're going to trigger it this week.
Which is really weird that the mom didn't want him
funeral.
Which mom?
Barbara did not want her at his.
But he's going to end up at her gravesite now.
No, not the gravesite.
No, he's not going to the gravesite. That's right. Okay.
They're buried in. They'll be buried in Texas
at
their museum.
Trump won't be there. That's right. Okay, I got you.
No, but listen, like I said, I'm not a fan of the son, but I want this family to be able to grieve.
Yeah.
I want them to say goodbye to their loved one, and I want the nation to say goodbye to
like the son. I don't like his policies. He made a lot of mistakes, but I don't think all the mistakes were his. Was his fault. I think Cheney was behind a lot of it.
Let me tell you something, brother. You put together a comedy show, and every comic you on that stage sucks dick. Now, you weren't the one performing, but you put him there to suck dick.
And I get blamed for him.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. So you say, well, I don't think it was W, but Cheney and this one and that one.
I don't know if W, I think Cheney came from the dad, though. I think he was trying to please his dad with a lot of his decisions. A lot of the decisions he made was to please his dad. Even hiring Cheney was to please his
listen,
dad.
Kev, listen, I got this comic. I really want you to put on the show. I mean, I know you heard about him. He's going to be great. So you do that for me. And then the guy drops his trowel and pisses on the front row. You don't give a shit how he got there. The fact of the matter is people are going to be complaining.
Yes.
I'm breaking down politics to producing comedy show terms. I understand what you're saying, but we used to have a thing in this country with the president where the buck stops here. I believe that was Harry S. Truman. I know we don't do that anymore. I know where the buck is over there, and the buck.
I also believe that presidents can redeem themselves when they leave office by their behavior, and I mean Bush is not that public, but I think you know, like Jimmy Carter was probably not the best president in the world, but when he left office, he done some good things, you know.
I don't think you can ever redeem. I think you can.
So Bush is now, I mean,
listen,
Junior is not the same as he was as he's in office.
Listen,
he's more likable now. He's doing talk shows and he, like I said, he's hanging out with Michelle Obama. So he has a new.
That's fine. But the fact of the matter is there's a lot of dead Americans and Iraqis. Because of him. So that's why it can't be redeemed. Listen, I don't hate him the way I used to, but that's because I'm looking at what I'm looking at now.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, if I wasn't looking at Agent Orange, I would still think this guy was the worst president of my lifetime. Now I have to weigh those considerations.
Well, there's no competition here. 45 is probably the worst.
Well,
president.
For a long time,
I would take a Bush Junior back right now.
Of course you would, because you're dealing with. Well, do I want vomit or dog shit? That's what you're talking about.
Which one is dog shit and vomit?
You pick. I mean, I hate to say it, but we got maimed and dead Americans because we went into a war that we never should have gone. I went there. Those kids never should have been in Iraq.
Right.
We never should have been there. That's on his hands. Mission accomplished. That was on his watch. Katrina, I don't think it was malice like Kanye made it sound like he doesn't like black people. But he was they were woefully bad. That was on their watch. You take responsibility.
Yes.
The economy going to shit at the end of his term, it's on his watch.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you know.
And that was a combination of 9/11, the war.
No, it was fucking tax cuts that couldn't be tax cuts during while we're fighting two wars and not paying for the wars.
So do we give Obama credit now for getting us out of that mess? Because he doesn't get any credit for getting us out of this mess.
By idiots. By partisan idiots. Of course he does. Yeah. Listen,
he got us out the mess.
Sure he did.
Yeah.
Sure he did. And you got to remember, John McCain and Barack Obama were called in off the campaign trail to meet with President Bush towards the end because they go, listen, you guys need to know what's going on.
Yes.
Good for Bush for doing that. Maybe he didn't have to do that. But still, that's how bad things were. Like, I mean, I can't believe we're having this discussion.
How do people forget how bad things were, though?
Because they're idiots. No, seriously.
Hey, idiots, if you're listening...
Idiots don't listen to my show.
Okay.
No, but Joe last week, he's like, are you calling people stupid? I go, yes. I go, why is this news to you? People are stupid. I say it all the time. People are stupid. They have the memory of a goldfish. They're morons. That's why we're in the mess we're in.
Yes.
I mean, it really is. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz was a moron. And the Democrats were morons for fixing it for Hillary instead of letting it play out, Bernie versus Hillary, like it should have. This moron.
Well, Bernie shouldn't have jumped in a race.
Well, whatever. The point of the matter is they fixed it so Bernie couldn't win. Now, maybe he wouldn't have won, but at least maybe you wouldn't have all the Bernie bros thinking it was stolen from them. And maybe they would have rallied around Hillary. And maybe we wouldn't have Agent Orange in here now. And you know, stupid people on the right, they think just because Daddy Warbucks Donald is a billionaire, which he probably isn't, that they're going to be billionaires just by voting for him, that he's going to make it rain. Like he's a rapper in a strip club. He's just going to make it rain, and we're all going to collect the money. That's what we're going to have a TV president. He's going to make it rain. We're all going to do, and we're not going to have the black guy anymore. That's what they fucking thought.
Well, that's what it's all about.
That's a big part of it.
95% of Donald Trump was about the black guy. Not the economy, because most people who now say the economy is better driving the same Datsun 210 they had when Obama was in office.
Donald Trump was a gag reflexes to 8 years of a black man. That's what it was.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
And anybody who could run a normal campaign who hadn't had 30 years of hate put out against them, some of it justifiably so, some of it not, would have won. But that didn't happen.
All right, so if we didn't have if Trump didn't win because of the gag reflex of the black guy, you will have that dynasty that you hate because Bush would Jed would be president right now if it wasn't for Donald Trump.
If the country if the country was smart, they would have had John Kasich as a candidate. Because the guy was a successful governor in a battleground state, was a successful congressman. Listen, there's things that the left he did that the left wouldn't like. I get that. But if you just wanted somebody who could get shit done and knew how to work with the other side when he had to and wasn't an extreme and wasn't polarizing, you would have had John Kasich. That's what you would have had.
It's not too late.
He might run, but I think it'll just be to siphon off votes for Trump. But... yeah, no. Trump is the gag reflex to the black guy. That's what it is. I know that. And people who would deny, listen, if you did any research on what Donald Trump was, and it's why he's so unpopular in New York and New Jersey because we knew the guy. If you did any research on the guy, you go, there's no way this guy should be president. I don't know if this guy should be allowed to have a Twitter account. I can't believe we give this guy a network TV show. But people don't do that. People are starstruck because we're idiots. That's why we clamor to meet famous people.
That is true.
Because we all just want to fame by association. But you are a famous person, my friend.
Yes, I am.
Let's shift it to you.
Semi.
You are a very famous comedian.
Almost famous.
And you have a book out. What's the book called, Kev?
The book is called Playing with Fire.
Playing with Fire.
Now, for two reasons.
Okay, explain those reasons.
One, I'm a magician comedian, so I play with fire on stage, as you know, David.
I do
fire tricks. I eat fire, and I do all sorts of other crazy things with fire. But also, playing with fire is sort of like my lifestyle.
Really? Because you strike me as a pretty much down-to-earth, as you said, a kale-drinking type of guy.
Well, I've grown.
Okay.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, baby.
You live that lifestyle?
Well, not the drugs.
Okay, you never did a drug?
Never done drugs in my life.
Never smoked a cigarette?
Never smoked a cigarette.
Me neither.
Never smoked marijuana.
Me neither.
Never done drugs a day in my life.
We are straight edge.
We are straight. We're weird comics.
We are.
Because you cannot get a room full of comedians that can say that.
You're absolutely correct.
And here's the deal. When I was a kid, I was into martial arts. And, of course, Bruce Lee was my hero. who was a hell fanatic who dropped dead at 32.
But, should have done the cocaine.
Yeah.
Look at these rock stars running around, cocaine hookers.
Yeah, Mick Jagger's still alive.
Exactly. And touring.
Bruce Lee made the wrong decision. But anyway, here's a 32-year-old man who dropped dead. But I was a kid. Bruce Lee was my hero. And he was a hell fanatic. So I wanted to have muscles like Bruce Lee, a body like Bruce Lee, and be Bruce Lee. So
you wanted to be an Asian man.
Martial arts. Well, I wanted an Asian lady, actually.
Really?
I thought I was going to grow up. Here's the deal. I'm going to grow up. I'm going to join the military, get stationed over in the Asian country, and marry some Asian girl. That was my childhood
fantasy. Had it all planned out.
Well, I ended up going overseas, but as an entertainer.
Oh, okay.
So I've been to Japan, and I've been to Korea, Seoul, Korea, and all. And,
as
and,
have
and,
I.
And as an entertainer.
Yeah.
And
You're performing for the military?
Yes.
Yeah, I've
been to all the bases overseas. I've got a lot of bases, not just in the Far East, but in Europe and all over. So,
sure.
Bahrain. The first Desert Storm, I went over to Bahrain.
Oh, cool.
And so...
That's another thing you and I have in common.
Yeah.
We have toured overseas for our military.
For our military, yes. They're great crowds.
They are.
They're great. Only
crowds I've ever had where they had their rifles right in front of them as I performed.
Now, I'm going to tell you something. I have an interesting experience. I performed at the DMZ Zone in Korea.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, at that base.
What was that base? I don't know if I performed there.
That base took us about... We stayed in Seoul, Korea, and I remember it wasn't a long drive to that base. I can't remember the name of the base because it was 1987 when I was over there, a long time ago.
I don't think I did that one.
They told us that our life expectancy, if something happened, was basically, you know.
What, if like North Korea like got all pissed?
Yeah, if something happened, 3 second life expectancy over there. And thanks for telling us we got to go do comedy now, you know. So,
yeah, but you know that. I mean, yeah. You know that going in. I mean, I dealt with
the I didn't know that. I was like 19 years old.
I dealt with the same shit in Iraq, although they never laid that out to me.
Well, you're a grown man when you went over. I was a young kid.
All right.
You know, who left the luxury of the middle class PG County, Maryland, hopped on a big plane and ended up in Tokyo as our first stop, and then ended up going over to Seoul for the first time. I was 18 years old on this tour. So, yeah, it was pretty interesting. I mean, my first time overseas, went to Busan and Osan, did all the bases over there, and a lot of fun. And I've did that tour like 4 times actually since the first time I went over. So
I haven't done a mil. I did that in 2008. I haven't been back, but the agency I went through, I don't know if they're still doing that now.
Yeah, my tour that I was on was sponsored by Miller Beer. It was called the Miller Comedy Tour.
Oh, nice!
And it actually wasn't like it was like a USO tour, USO tour, but we got treated like stars because Miller Beer, Philip Morris Company. Flipped the bill
that's not every tour.
We got the luxury treatment. We flew business class and first class on, and we stayed in luxury hotels.
Yeah, me and
like
Dennis
that.
Flew coach.
Yeah, see, that's a different thing. And unfortunately, I mean, I won't say unfortunately, we're paid pretty handsomely for the tour, which, you know, when you perform for the military, you kind of feel guilty about that you're over.
Well, we were not paid handsomely when I went, so I did not have that.
So it was different times, man. So, yeah, but I was a young kid over there, you know, it was different times.
So what made you want to be an entertainer? So you're into martial arts.
I'm into martial arts. I saw some guy doing card tricks on television, TV Magic Cards. I don't remember TV Magic Cards.
No.
There's a commercial called TV Magic Cards. We show a deck of cards, and you flip it over, and all the cards are gone. The faces are empty, and you flip it again, and all the cards are back. It's called TV Magic Cards.
Okay.
You can Google it. It's really cool. So I saw this guy doing the card tricks on television, and I was like, I want to do that. So
how old were you?
I was 13.
Okay.
13 years old. Saw a guy doing TV Magic Cards, and I got that deck of cards for my birthday. My brother put up the money. My birthday is right around the corner. I think the deck of cards was like maybe $10 back in those days at People's Drugstore, which later turned to CVS.
Okay.
Yes. So before CVS, there was People's Drugstore in the Washington, D.C. area. So I got this deck of cards, and that was it. My life changed right there. I wanted to be Doug Henning. At the time, Doug Henning was what Chris Angel and David Copperfield are. You know, is now. He was the big.
So yours is a little different because a lot of performers, a lot of comedians, and I fall. It was to me, but a lot of them are pushed into it because of pain. Something traumatic happens to them, and for whatever comedy or music is the way that they can express themselves and deal with what's going on. But that wasn't it for you.
Well, I had a lot of pain in my childhood. You know,
well, that's what I'm talking because you're a child.
Yeah,
when you say I want to do this.
Yeah, I want to do this. You know, and I always had. A gift of gab. I was always the one in my family that loved to perform. So, you know, family reunions, I tell you a quick story. I was watching Jerry Lewis Telethon.
Okay.
And Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Dean Martin were on, and they were dancing and singing and having a ball with Jerry Lewis. And that blew me away because I'm maybe 12 years old watching that. Mm-hmm. It's before the magic. I was like, I want to be like those guys when I grew up. So I already wanted to be like them before I saw the magician guy. I wanted to be a singer. I wanted to be in show business.
Right. You knew you wanted the adulation of strangers.
Yes.
It's true. That's what it is.
But watching Sammy and Frank and Dean and Jerry Lewis at the time and being 12 years old and watching them entertain was the most magical thing I've ever seen at that point, you know, because
sure.
They were just
You hadn't discovered
brilliant.
Breasts yet.
They were brilliant.
Breasts would be the most magical thing you'd seen later on.
I discovered breasts once I started touring.
And then all of a sudden, card tricks weren't quite as magical.
Exactly. Well, card tricks got me laid a lot. So, yeah. Hey, being a magician, also, believe it or not, was shy. So being a magician broke the ice for me to meet a lot of girls, you know.
Yeah, that's a great.
Yeah, it was a great way.
So your brother buys you the cart. So was your family supportive of this
pursuit?
They were
very supportive until I started failing in school. Yeah.
What? Why were you failing?
Because magic took over everything. I didn't want to do anything but be a magician. I wanted to learn magic. I used to go to school. I got kicked out of school for doing card tricks in the middle of my class, you know.
Did you finish high school?
Yes, I did. Okay. Yeah. Barely.
So there was no college for you?
No college.
So you were all
by the time college came around, I was a touring comedian. I mean, by the time I was at age to go be to college, I was a touring comedian.
How old were you when you started touring?
I was making a lot of money as a kid. I was doing birthday parties. Back in the day, I was a professional clown. So I did the clown and the birthday party stuff when I was like 15, 16 years old. I was working. I was making, you know, $300 to $500 a week doing that stuff.
How much?
$300 to $500 a week.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Not bad for a 16-year-old.
No, not at all.
Then I got hired to work at amusement parks, so I was doing some amusement parks.
What, like balloon animals?
No, I was working as a street performer at amusement parks.
So, wait,
Kings and Minions.
I thought when I think of street performers, I think of like the subway or like parks.
No.
This was an amusement park.
This is an amusement park.
So it's a little safer.
Yeah, it's very safe. Well, you have a stage, and it's set up, you know, like a Kabibo stage or whatever, and people come up and the show's at 3:30, you know, people walk up and watch the show.
So, okay.
Yeah, so it's me and a friend of mine who was a clown and a unicycle rider, and I did the magic.
Seems
and,
so wholesome.
No, it was wholesome, yeah, until comedy came. Comedy changed everything.
So you're doing this magic, you think you're going to be a magician, and what happened? And then comedy, how did you discover? How'd you make the transition?
I was street performing in Washington, D.C. on the streets, like, you know, they do in New York. And I took my act down to the National Mall where the tourist was.
So you did work the streets?
I did work the real streets, yes. I worked the real streets also. So, yeah, you had the paid gig at the music park, but I had to go down to work the real streets, you know, use my talent, pimp my talent, and, you know, make
Not
money.
Not scary at all?
Nothing was scary back in those days, you know. We're talking the early 80s. Yeah, it was a different world, you know.
A lot of violence.
Yeah, but, you know, I grew up in the D.C., Maryland area, so to me it was just another day. So, you know, young kid, go down that street, perform, used to get, you know, run off by the police because they said it was against the law to stand on the corner and street perform on the National Mall. So we got chased a lot by the police. But we come back and make some more money. But I met a guy who was a comic that was down there working. And he says, hey, they have a comedy competition at the Comedy Cafe in Washington, D.C. And they hold open mics down there also. So I went to one of the open mics and then I did this, entered this comedy competition. And I won first place.
Really?
Yes.
Well, you were already a seasoned performer.
Yes. Now, one of the comedians that I beat, believe it or not, was Al Gore's roommate in college, Bob Summerby.
Okay.
A comedian named Bob Summerby out of Baltimore.
Name. Okay.
And they used to have a comedy club there called Baltimore Comedy City Lights in Baltimore.
Okay.
Yeah. So Bob Summerby and I forgot the other guy, his partner, but Bob Summerby was a professional comic, and he also was Al Gore's roommate in college. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So after that, it was over. I stayed in the comedy clubs and
because you're different.
Yeah,
You know, most comics, you know, are they stand there, they tell jokes. You got a lot of different things.
Being
balls up in the air, so to speak.
Yeah, so my balls are in my pants.
So you're starting out in this comedy scene. You're already doing well.
And this is in the middle of the '80s. I mean, the comedy boom.
The
by
boom.
The way. Yes.
So was who really helped you out as an up and comer?
Believe it or not. It was just so easy to get work back in those days. I tell comics now, you wouldn't believe how easy it was to get work. First, it was a lot of work during the boom. Some of the guys now that aren't really big now were big back in the 80s, like Andy Scarpetti, if I can say his name. back in the day in the 80s, Andy was really big.
Really?
Yes, and had lots of rooms and paid very well.
But was he big as a performer?
I'm not talking about as a performer. I'm talking about his venues.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Doing the comedy, his venues. I remember the first time I performed at a comedy cabaret was in Dover. It was in Delaware, and it was five shows, two on Friday, three on Saturday, seven, I believe, 9 and 11, and every show was sold out.
Yeah, it's not happening anymore.
Yeah, those days are over for anybody.
Well, not for anybody.
I don't know if people selling out three shows on a Saturday night anymore.
Some people are.
Yeah, well.
Not many.
Yeah, down south maybe, and celebrities do, but
yeah.
Come on.
Local celebrities, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, three shows on a Saturday night, you know,
so
all
it's,
sold
it's
out.
Not like that anymore.
For unknown comics, though, just guys who are just, you know, good acts, you know. Back in those days, people came to the comedy clubs to laugh and get drinks, and now people come to see celebrities and YouTube stars.
Speaking of celebrities, were there any celebrities that you met that really disappointed you as a person? Like you really admired their work?
Well, that was later on in my career.
All right, let's name some names.
Bill Cosby.
Well, he didn't put anything in your drink.
No, he did not.
That's why you're disappointed.
I worked, I was on a tour, and I worked with Bill Cosby in, what was it, San Diego, a place called Humphreys on the Bay.
Okay.
It was an amphitheater. And Bill Cosby was there. He was the host of the show. I was on tour. It was a jazz festival. I was with Wynton Marsalis, who was a, you know, famous jazz artist, mm-hmm. Wynton Marsalis. And I was touring with him. That was one of the stops, was the Playboy Jazz Festival. Mm-hmm. And Bill Cosby was there. He's, you know, one of the guys. And he was a very prima donna type, you know, very snooty, snobby.
Felt he made it seem like he was better than you.
Well, he was at the time.
No, but
I'm just saying.
No, but you know, listen, there's no reason to act like we were just talking about a man who George H.W.
Yes,
Bush,
yeah.
Who made everybody feel special.
Right.
And now we're talking about a guy who did not, which is
exactly,
a problem.
Yeah.
Well, one guy's a president of the United States.
Yeah, one guy's a famous entertainer. So, yeah, so he was, I mean, when I think back of all the celebrities I've met, and I've met plenty in my life at this stage, he's one of the guys that was disappointed because I was a big fan, you know.
Sure, a lot of us were big
fans.
This
is way before the scandal, though.
Well, the scandal—it was already out there.
This is actually 2004.
Shit was already out there.
Yeah,
it just wasn't discussed.
It wasn't discussed.
But it was already out there. There was already the allegations.
Yeah, in 2004. Yeah, so this was.
So let me ask you this: like, because in the black community, Cosby was pretty controversial because he was coming down on black men. You know, pull up your pants, this, that, the other
yes.
thing. You're a black man. Did you have that view that he was controversial? Or were you thinking, you know what, preach it, Bill. You're right.
I agreed with him.
Okay.
So no, I didn't. And if people are controversial now because he got in trouble or whatever, but
there's nothing controversial now. Now we
yeah,
all know
exactly,
he's a scumbag.
Exactly.
But
I'm saying when he was saying that,
right?
You know, I was agreeing with him. I think guys should pull up their pants. Mm-hmm. It disgusts me. It's disgusting to see that, you know, guys just sagging their pants down and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's a fad I thought would go away, but guys are still doing it. I thought, okay, this is the end of the year, or this is the end of a couple of years, but it's been years, and guys are still walking around with their pants sagging, you know. I can't put my finger on that one.
So do you think, so the props, the fire, the chainsaws, the juggling, that's helped you in comedy?
It's helped and hurt, and this is very interesting. I'm African American. I'm not. I mean, how many African American prop comics have you seen in your life?
I see many with weapons.
Okay, that's funny. I got arrested for going through the airport with my props once too. Man,
got arrested.
BWI Airport. On my way to a college gig, and performing at Mitchell College in Connecticut. Mitchell College in Connecticut.
Okay.
My girlfriend dropped me off at the airport, and. I go in with my props, and I put some of the bags underneath. This happened way before 9/11, so it wasn't like the paranoia that goes mm-hmm. on. But I had some nunchucks in my carry-on luggage
mm-hmm.
that I use on stage because I used to do a martial arts bit on stage, you know. And I had the nunchucks in my carry-on luggage, and it went through the little converter belt. They saw it in the X-ray. They pulled them out. In the state of Maryland, nunchucks are considered a deadly weapon.
And you did not know that.
I didn't know that.
You do now.
I do now. I was handcuffed and taken into... Under the jail cell, which I sit in for about 6 hours,
ugh.
Missed my $1,500 college gig.
Ugh.
Yes. And the agency dropped me.
Because you missed the gig.
Not because I missed the gig, because the college dropped them because I was the second comedian from that agency that they had trouble with.
Wow.
Yeah. So
at least you can understand it.
He lost a very healthy contract because of that incident.
See, here's why I would think it would help you, because like we touched on, there's not a lot of people like you with your skill set doing what you do.
Yes.
And people like you get compared to people like me who tell jokes. That's the gimmick. That's all we there's right. No juggling, there's no chainsaws, there's right. No flame. I got so there's 50 weeks a year of guys like me coming through,
right.
And there's maybe 2 weeks a year, so I would think it would help you, but you're saying it hurt you too.
Well, it hurts because most agencies, I try not to call myself a prop comic.
I look at you as an entertainer. I mean, I know we are looked at as the same, but for me, you and I do completely different things.
Yes, and it's always been the battle between the monologist and the prop
guy. I don't look at it as a battle. I get why clubs would want you in. I just get upset when they compare me to you.
Well, clubs do want me in once they see me, because they go, okay, this guy's a crowd pleaser and the audience loves him.
Right.
You wouldn't believe how much trouble I go through because my agent that books me may have on his website prop comic. So people have, when you say prop comic, then people automatically think of a Gallagher or a Lenny Schultz or
yeah, but those
or
guys
Carrot
work.
Top.
Yeah, but those guys work.
But they're still considered black eyes on the industry.
By who? By people who aren't making the type of money they're making.
Yes, but
people who are making money are the people who are hiring those people.
That is true. I mean, I agree with you. I think that but prop comedy is a black eye, like being a ventriloquist, I mean, or being a guitar guy, a guitar act, you know.
See, but I don't – I mean, I think if you're looking at industry rooms, I could see why.
Yes.
But if you're looking at the majority of the work we do – which are on the road or on cruise ships or middle America. They just want to be entertained.
I was told when I first moved to New York by a booker, the Broadway Comedy Club, by the way, who told me, I won't mention his name, but you know what I'm talking about.
The guy who owns it now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Martin. Okay. That's
fine.
Al Martin? Okay.
You just did. It's fine.
Well, okay. Well, you know, he was cool. I was recommended.
Comic. He's a comic.
I was recommended by somebody to showcase for him.
Mm-hmm.
I go in. I go up, I showcase. I've been living in New York for all of, 3 months. And he pulls me to the back room after my set, and he goes, loved it. He goes, you can work for me anytime. Call me. I got you on. The other problem is nobody in this town is going to touch you for 10-foot pole because of what you do. And because you're a prop guy. He goes, I just saw what you did to my audience, and that's all I care about.
Right. Well, he's a comic.
But the other guys that book rooms care about what you do more than what the audience likes, you know? So,
well, because he knows.
So that's what he told me. And he said, they're not going to touch you for 10-foot pole. So, of course, I walked out with my head down. With that being said, I've been in New York for now 9 years. I'm probably one of the busier acts working out of New York.
You are.
You know?
No, you definitely are. And I think that's why I think it helps you. Because clubs want to bring you in. They want you on their calendar because they don't have a lot of people like you on their calendar. Now, I don't think there's a lot of people that can do what I do personally.
True.
But they don't get past the fact, another monologist, bang, got our guys, this, that, the other thing. You stand out, so I would think that you would be able to work, but I would see why maybe TV doesn't want to do anything with
you. But see, my agent, here's a perfect example. One of my agents was involved with a industry showcase for NBC's Last Comic Standing was holding auditions.
Right.
And my agent didn't even send me down for the audition because he didn't think that a guy like me would get the show.
He overthought it.
Yeah. Oh, they're not going to want a prop guy on the show.
Yeah, because he overthought it.
My friend Wanda Sykes, who produced the show, she called me up and she says, hey, would you like to audition for Last Comic Standing? I'm the producer. I said, yes. So I go down there and I audition, and guess who gets the show?
Right. Well, listen.
I got the show, and the guys that the other acts that got sent down from the same agency that I'm with, none of them got the show.
Well, you and I have talked about this. I've talked about it with other comics. The people that we call industry right now are the people that were fetching the coffee for the people that made Ray Romano a star. They're not really industry. They're just the leftovers. That's what we're dealing with. That's the reality. The real industry, the people who had vision,
yes,
have moved on. They're doing bigger. They're still working with Ray Romano and Drew Carey and doing this, that. We're doing the girl who answered the phone. So they don't have vision. They don't understand that, hey, you know what? This series of ours, Last Comic Standing, nobody's really watching. It's drowning. Maybe we should try to put something a little different in there just for a long. Just put him on. He doesn't even have to advance.
And skin color has something to do with this, too, by the way.
As far as what?
Well, I had a veteran comic out of Washington, D.C. I started my career in D.C., and he's like a D.C. legend.
Who's this?
And he says to me, his name is the Fat Doctor.
I know the Fat Doctor.
So the doc says to me, he says, you know, if you were a white guy with your act, you'd be a lot further than you are. And I'm in a good place, but you know what he's saying. And I thought about it for a minute, and I go, Doc, you're right. And I'm going to tell you why. Because, yes, you have the amazing Jonathans who you know, out there who are making millions, and of course, Kurt Top making millions. But like I said, are there a lot of African Americans who do what I do? No.
See, I don't know.
There isn't.
Because then I got Joe Curry. We had this conversation a couple months ago, and he's like, you know, being a white male is the worst thing you could be in comedy. And then I had Pip. I go through the clubs across the country. Give me some of their calendars. And it was a lot of white males. So you got.
Well, that's changing now too. In the A rooms, and you want to explain it to your audience if they don't know.
The A rooms are the best rooms, the best of the best, where you're going to get the big names.
Yeah.
The people you see.
The improvs and the funny bones of the world, if I can say that, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you look at their rosters now, there are a lot of African-Americans headlining these rooms now because right now African-American comics are draws.
That's been like that for a long time, though.
But if you look at their rosters, you'll see a lot of African Americans are household names, you know, guys who have sitcoms.
Yeah, but you see, I think they're household names to the black community. But like most of the time, I think a lot of white people, unless they're tied into like black entertainment, don't know. Like you give me.
Well, Sean Wayans, and I mean the Wayans are the
Wayans brothers. I'll give you.
And Tommy Davidson.
All these people were big in the 90s. We're not talking about new stars. We're talking about people from the 90s.
Yeah, but a lot of the white guys on these rosters are guys that nobody knows. You know.
Yeah, but what I'm telling you is the guys that name themselves after food and natural disasters, you know.
Are we talking about Earthquake on a sneak tip again?
Well, there's a whole bunch of them. Unless you're tied into, like, black entertainment and black means, the average white person doesn't know who they are. But the Wayans brothers, everybody knows who they are because they were on network TV.
Yes.
But
all these guys have draws, though.
Right, amongst black people.
Okay.
And white people who happen to know what black people like. But the average suburban people have never heard of a hamburger. If they show up, they just happen to be going to a comedy club that night, and hamburger was there.
Hamburger.
It's just like if people show up. If you and I are there, they happen to show up, and maybe they are fans. The average suburban white person in their 40s does not know from a hamburger. They do not know from an earthquake.
Well, then they need to watch Def Comedy Jam.
It's on Netflix. No, they don't.
And I'm on Netflix right now, by the way.
Are you?
Yes, I'm on a Def Comedy Jam anniversary.
Wow, that's.
That was the hottest show in the country.
You know what?
At one point, with the original. And a groundbreaking show. I was on the original show.
All right, fine. When you had those people and guys like DL and I can't think of his name, the little one with the mustache.
Martin?
Yes.
Well, Martin was the host.
Right. But I'm saying, when you had that original.
The little guy.
I couldn't remember.
He's the biggest star in the world.
No, but I should have known. Absolutely. I should have known. What I'm saying is, the original incarnation of it.
Right.
It's undeniable. There was a lot of talent there.
Yes.
But for me, who came to it a little bit later on, enough. Like the Southern acts.
Well, look, I grew up watching, before Def Comedy Jam and before Urban Comics got on television, other than Apollo, I had to sit through Even at the Improv.
That was not good for anybody.
Which was the worst thing ever put on television.
Oh, that was not. But that was how comedy got saturated, because you had a lot of people who should not have been on TV.
Yeah.
Well,
Def Comedy Jam.
Was the same thing.
Actually
became
segregated
that.
Comedy. Well, it didn't. The bookers.
Right.
Segregated
that's
comedy.
That's when we had, quote unquote, urban weeks.
Yeah, urban nights.
We couldn't just say black week. We couldn't just say black week. We couldn't just say black week. We're having urban weeks. That's what we're having. Okay.
Yeah,
and I did those urban weeks. I was one of the white
guys. I did a lot of the urban weeks, and it was really weird because I was working in the mainstream rooms as a headliner. Then after doing Def Comedy Jam, I got put into the urban nights, even though I'm not really an urban comic. I mean, I'm African American, but my style of comedy.
No, but they're just looking at your skin color.
They were looking at my skin color. So yeah, I was performing in front of groups that really didn't dig what I do, you know, because I was on the show. I did well on the show. I actually killed on the show.
I would think what you do Because you don't have to talk that much. You pretty much rip on the audience.
See, Mac, I talk a lot.
Yeah, but you're not telling jokes. I mean, right. They are jokes. They're jokes geared to the physical towards the physical activities that you are doing.
Yes.
Though it's not like you're waxing poetic about topical stuff and you rip on the audience, which translates for anybody and especially black people.
Yes.
So I would think that could get you through.
Yeah.
The fact that you are adept at ripping on people.
Well, no, you're right. And
that's what got me through with black audience.
That's what got me through, actually. Yes.
Before I could perform in front of black people with my material, I'm talking about not black people, black audiences. Before right. I could do that, what got me through was crowd work.
Right.
The fact that I could just rip and be fearless. Now I do it with my material, but at the time my material was cheesy, corny, whatever the fuck they thought they were buying.
But being on TV, you can't do crowd work.
Correct.
And I was on the I was on Showtime at the Apollo.
Paula Poundstone did a special of crowd work.
Well, that's her special, not doing a set on Def Jam or the Apollo.
Right.
You can't come out on Showtime at the Apollo and start on a guy's shirt.
No, Showtime at Apollo, you got to bring it right from the word
there
jump.
There you go.
And there's no easing into it.
And I killed on that show, too, by the way. So my act works for my people.
But how do...
My act
works. Yeah, you and Mandela, the two biggest heroes for black people. But, I mean, I would think... So you think it costs you some opportunities at the higher levels.
At the higher level, yes.
But it's helped you because you do work more than most.
Well, yeah, at a certain level, though. It helps me as a road comic. As
right,
a road comic, but I'm talking about getting to the next level. No producer has come to me and say, hey, this guy here, I'll give you a perfect example. Dave Cohen.
Who's that?
Dave Cohen was in the 90s, probably one of the top college bookers in the country.
Okay.
He had a company called Dancing Bear, and it was in Bayside, New York. And he saw my tape from a TV show that I did. And he says, you are a black prop guy, a black guy with props. And he said this to me on the phone, just before the cell phones. He goes, I'm going to make a lot of money off of you. And he had me...
Like a good plantation owner should.
Yes. His last name was Cohen.
Listen, we Jews like to make money. What are you going to
do? He had me in almost every university and college across the country. I was one of the busiest college acts in the 90s.
And that's how you make money.
And I made a lot of money. He made a lot of money.
But see, here's
I made a lot of money.
But you're telling me.
But he had a vision. He knew what he could get.
But that goes back to my point. Those people knew, had a vision.
He
now
knew.
They don't. But you just said, you know, I didn't get these TV breaks. And you
well,
just
I'm
dropped a bunch
guys,
of TV breaks.
I'm talking about guys like Russell Simmons type of guy. I've been on all the black television. I've been on Def
Comedy
Jam.
That still counts.
I've been. Well, yeah.
That counts. That's legitimate.
Okay, they're legitimate shows.
So it hasn't hurt you. So you're working. No, seriously, let's break. You're working successfully as a road comic. You're busier.
Yes, I'm a very busy
busier
road
than
comic.
Most. And you got a bunch of TV credits. Did you get the sitcom? No, nobody's getting sitcoms right now.
Yes,
nobody's getting sitcoms right now. And really, let's be honest. But if we looked at your act, how would you build a sitcom around that? It's not like you're talking. It's not like there's a story.
They build a sitcom around with Tim Allen. In his
right, it was built on a character.
Right.
There's no character in your act, and right. Unless you would have to write something starring you. The average person isn't going to go see this guy who's entertaining an audience with chainsaws and ripping on people. Go, oh, I see a 30 half hour episodes right there. It's just the reality of it.
Well, I'm working on my special, so.
So, I want to talk about a little something a little darker.
Okay, let's talk about it, buddy.
So I know your sister was killed.
Yes, and that's in the book.
As a performer, how are you able to cope with that while still doing your shows? Because most of us, we don't stop. You know,
right.
People don't know how much pain a lot of time we're in. Like,
yeah.
Somebody passes away, like your sister. Like, did you take some time?
No, I actually had to perform that week. I didn't take off that week. The week that my sister was murdered, she was 38 years old, by the way, and she was killed with her two kids, my niece and nephew.
Ugh.
Yeah, they were all... gunned down in their apartment. Yeah.
Was it somebody she knew?
Yes.
So it was a domestic violence type deal?
No, it wasn't domestic violence. It was a apparent drug. My sister had some marijuana possession, and she was involved with marijuana.
Deal?
No, she wasn't a dealer.
She was a user.
She was a user, but she had a friend that, we won't call him a friend. She had
an acquaintance?
An acquaintance that, stashed some drugs at her house.
Okay.
A large amount of marijuana that mysteriously ended up missing.
Oh, jeez.
And because the marijuana was missing, this drug dealer had to take action because he had to answer to...
They always got to answer. Somebody's got to answer to somebody
he
else.
He had to answer to the bigger guy.
Did your sister know that this was being stashed at her house?
She knew it was being stashed at her house. So when the drugs were missing, he went to his car, got a gun, and came back. And he killed her, and he killed the niece and the nephew.
Ugh.
And he killed the kid's aunt, who was there also. So it was four people murdered in the apartment, yeah.
Is the guy in jail?
They found him. He's in jail, and he got life in prison and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah. So
that's brutal.
Yeah, so it was a quadruple murder. My family had to deal with the loss of my sister. And I had to go, I went on stage and performed that week. I was devastated.
How do you do it? I mean, people don't understand.
Because as entertainers, man, we deal with, you know, I've gone on stage in the middle of going through a tough divorce. You know, I've gone on stage the death of my sister. I've gone on stage when I was homeless. You know, I was homeless at one point when I taped BT's Comic View. I was living in the back of my van.
You were the creepy guy down in the van down by the river.
I was living in my van, man. And I
was it a white van? Because I told my daughter the other day. The creeps always have the white van.
Here I'm in New Orleans taping this television show, Comic View, in New Orleans. And I get dressed in my van. I go inside. I film a TV show in front of TV cameras in this big, elaborate theater. And then I go sleep in my van that night because, you know, that's the way it was, you know. Performing on national television, taping a TV show. People don't understand it, man. Everybody who saw in that audience thinks you're rich and famous, yeah. You know, because you're in front of the cameras.
So when I find, and I know a lot of performers find, that when a lot of bad shit's going on in our life, sometimes the only place we feel right is on that stage. It's a refuge for us. Are you the same way?
I'm the same way. You won't be surprised. But, yeah, when you get on that stage, you know, you're in a zone. You know, you can have a big argument with the wife or problems with the kids or anything going on in your personal life. We have to shut it off when we get on stage, you know.
So it actually acts like...
Because I have so many people come up, and you probably had this, people come up to the show and tell you how much they're going through and right. How much your show helped. Right. I had a lady who lost her husband to cancer come up to me and go, I just lost my husband, and my friends forced me to come up to a comedy show, and I didn't really want to go, but they wanted me to get out the house, and I loved the show so much, and you made me laugh.
Those are great nights for us when we hear those stories.
And we hear them a lot. Yeah.
It makes us feel valuable, like we're actually doing something.
Well, we are. We bring laughter
but we
to
don't,
a tough
we don't
world.
But we don't have that... We don't really have that escape because we are entertainers.
Yeah. No, we don't have that escape. Our escape, I guess, is the stage.
Is the stage. Well, our job.
Or most entertainers, drugs and alcohol. Right. You know, most of us and I say, turn to drugs and alcohol.
Are you like a mess right before you hit that stage and then you hit the stage and the switch goes on and you're just in the zone?
There you go, man. I'm in the zone when I get on stage. But it's always something going on in our lives, you know, because we're not. Big stars. We're not at, you know. Then you think if you're a big star, all your problems will go away. But when you become a big star, you still have problems, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of stars have so many problems, you know, with the drugs and alcohol, because when they're at our level, they have the emotional problems. And when they get the millions of dollars, they still have those problems, you know. So
I'll let you know when I get those new problems.
Yeah, I want the million-dollar problems. So,
is there any way that pain motivates you? I mean,
well, I had a lot of guilt for years, and I still do. I always thought that my sister was in a bad place financially to the point where she was around the drugs and dealing with the drugs and stuff mm-hmm. like that because I always said, oh, if I was rich and famous, you know, she wouldn't have to be selling marijuana or whatever, you know.
So you feel, hey, if I was more successful, maybe
she
would have
been in that position, yeah.
That's a burden, man.
Oh, that's a lot of guilt that I dealt with for years.
You know
man.
What? You should have said that to the bookers when you were negotiating your money. Go, listen, motherfucker.
That's a good point, yeah.
You give me another $2,000, I could get my sister out of a bad situation.
Man, and they put me, I mean, I have that guilt still, dude. I mean, I still deal with that, you know. That
really?
I still deal with
But you know it's not rational.
Well, no, I don't believe that. I believe if I was, everybody tells me it's not. Oh, well, Kevin, your sister still is going to be in that position.
She would just
even
be,
if you were Eddie Murphy, you know, you still.
But I could just say, you know what? Your sister would just have access to better drugs, and she still became the same type of characters.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, yeah. You know,
because a lot of rich people have the same problems.
Listen,
you know?
I mean,
Sugar Ray Leonard, who's a childhood hero of mine, his family. I should put this on the air, but his sister had drug problems. She didn't. Well, she wasn't murdered, but she had major drug problems.
Right.
You know, so. Even rich people's family has drug problems.
Right, yeah. And, you know, so you could say an addiction is a sickness. It might be. I'm not going to argue that. But the choice to hang out with those bad people, that's a decision.
Well, she was around bad people.
She made the decision to let that guy bring the marijuana into the house where her kids were.
Well, Dr. Phil all of a sudden? No.
I'm very smart. No, but I mean, listen, you can't hold yourself, and I walk through shit all the time, and Joe too. You can't hold yourself responsible for that. Right. That was a that was a decision, a very poor decision.
Yes.
So even if you gave her the mansion, she might have been doing coke and hanging out and hanging out with people that are in the cocaine world.
I look at it from that point of view sometimes, but I still have the guilt there.
I get
that. I deal with, you know. I just deal with it. She's my younger sister, you know, and you know, she was 38 when she was murdered.
I'm sure your mom's told you it's not you.
Yeah, you know, I wrote about it in the book. You know, I talk about it a lot. The whole thing in the book, you know, about the murder. And I'm a comedian, and I wrote a book, and I'm talking about murder in my book, you know.
Yeah, but you're a human being. People don't get that. So people think that we're always on, we're always funny. No, we got real lives.
So people bought the book, and then they go on Amazon and go, I got Kevin Lee's book, and they leave great reviews. They love the book.
Mm-hmm.
They go, I expected to laugh, and I cried, you know. I hear people say that, you know.
Well, you know what? Well, one of the reasons is a lot of famous comedians have put out books that are just essentially their act. It's like, okay, I'm not doing this hour anymore. Seinfeld's put out a bunch of those. Ellen's put out a bunch of those.
Right.
And then you have people like Fran Drescher who put out books more like yours where she talks about how she was raped and everything.
Yeah.
So they don't know what they're getting.
Yeah.
Although I would not expect to laugh at a prop guy's book. I would expect shit to pop. I would expect it to be a pop-out book.
But there's lots of pictures in there if you can't read.
I would expect
the
that.
Celebrities.
I would expect pictures.
There's lots of pictures with Gladys Knight and Jamie Foxx and Tommy Davis and everybody famous is in that book. And all sorts of pictures. Famous people in the
but
book.
I mean, people don't
Michael Jackson. I met Michael Jackson.
Listen, we have people who we respect their talents, whether it be athletes or performers and everything. And it's probably hard for us to picture them as everyday people. We just think they have everything perfect. So
well, we know better. Yeah.
We
know
do.
A lot of famous entertainers. We see what they go
through. Right, but people see you on stage. You're a happy guy. Yours is a very happy act.
It's a happy act, yeah.
It's a very upbeat, happy act. That's why you said you're a crowd pleaser. Yeah, you are. When I'm on the stage, it's happy, but I'm going to talk about some shit.
Right. You're going to talk about some shit, yeah.
We're going to talk about shit that is going on that is bothering me. So if they saw those type of things in my book, if they saw that, they might not be surprised.
But see, I was told not to do a Trump joke in front of I played a gig, and they're like, this is Trump country. Don't do any Trump jokes.
So what'd you do?
I'm on stage. Where?
No, I'm not going to ask. Where'd you do it? You did it, right? The joke.
Yeah, I did the joke. And
good
the audience
boy.
Loved it.
They damn loved right.
It. But it wasn't. It's just my Trump joke. It wasn't a bashing joke. It just I was afraid that if a black guy says something about Trump, the audience is going to turn on him. And actually, they didn't. They loved it. Now, I'm going to tell you something that happened on this stage. I'll mention it real quickly. I had a guy in the front, and I had said something. He goes, Trump 2020. And he was being a complete dick in the crowd turned on him. They were loving my show so much,
I've
they wanted
that.
Him to sit down and shut the fuck up.
I've had that, you know, where people would just be like shouting Trump and people like Trump. Like, Trump brings out a whole weird thing in audiences that I've never seen with any other. Like, you could, as a comic, we could always joke on every politician. Trump, for some of you, sphincters get really fucking
so tight. If I lied to him, I say, look, man, I got 20 more minutes on stage, and then you can get out of here and go get in your white van, your white panel van, and get and leave. An audience bust out laughing, so they kind of.
Yeah, that's something how it's changed. I think we're people now tell us what they think we should do during our show on stage.
Yeah.
I don't think that was so much a thing back in the day, probably when you were coming up.
Well, no, it wasn't. I just had an interesting thing. I just posted a picture of Steve Martin on my Facebook wall because I'm a big Steve Martin fan, and I was talking about if Steve Martin was performing today because he'd used a lot of props.
Yeah,
would Steve Martin today be successful with that act?
No,
he wouldn't be.
He'd be a road act.
Yeah, he'd be a road act. Yeah, he would not be selling out stadiums. He would not be.
We know exactly which agencies he'd be working for too.
Yeah, exactly. He'd be a road act right now. Exactly. Yeah. He'd be sitting here at Devin's den tonight telling some hard stories. Actually, so yeah, no, he'd be a road act. Yeah, he would not be the Steve Martin that we know and love today. You know?
Right.
So yeah. So, you know, the times have changed, you know, comics, you know.
What do you think's the biggest change from the industry when you were coming up to what it is now? What do you think's the biggest change?
For road comics or just the industry, period?
Industry.
The biggest change is, one, we're not allowed to be ourselves anymore. And even guys who, like yourself, who say, I'm going to be myself no matter what, you're still held accountable. Even if it's not publicly, secretly you are. You know what I'm saying? Look, back in the day, you know, even when I was on some of the TV shows back in the day, I did some stuff. I did a homosexual joke at a college. I did a lot of colleges, I just finished telling you. And I had a homosexual juggling. I don't know if you ever see me do that. The homosexual
juggling. Yes, I've seen it. With the scarves.
Yeah, with the scarves.
That's pretty. It's a staple of your act.
And I did it on HBO, on Def Comedy Jam.
Oh, they like that.
Now,
those black people are some homophobes.
Now, and I've also done that bit in front of plenty of gay people.
Yeah.
Now gay people complain about that bit.
Really?
Yes. Now,
really?
That bit wasn't,
I find gay people embrace that you're including them.
That bit wasn't offensive to gay people.
All right, explain what the bit is.
I pull out the scarves and I go homosexual juggling. I do the body language with it as I fling the scarves.
Limp wrist, scarves floating.
Yeah, yeah.
Pink scarves, orange scarves.
Yeah, and I'm basically doing the hand gestures.
You're a flamboyant man.
I'm very flamboyant and stereotypical of what you think of when you think of a gay guy.
Right.
Yeah, okay, that sort of thing. So, and it's a funny bit. And it's always gotten big laughs and applause.
Sure.
It's been a part of my show for all of 25 years.
So you think it's the political correctness that's the thing.
And now I'm being told not to do the bit. I've had people complain about the bit. I mean, gay people weren't offended by the bit 25 years ago, but now they are.
Like, this has happened more than once.
Yes, it's happened more than once.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
crazy.
To
the point where I didn't even pull it out of my bag over the weekend in Washington, D.C. I performed at a comedy club there. I did not pull out the bag. The comedy club I was performing at was in Georgetown, which is right next to DuPont Circle, which is a big gay area in Washington, D.C. So
okay.
a lot of people in my audience were gay couples.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, they're going to be offended if I do this. Even though I know I've done this bit 1,000 times, 200,000 times, and nobody's ever. But now people are offended by it. I've had some club bookers come up and say somebody complained about it. You know,
the booker should just shrug their shoulders when somebody complains. Okay.
Well, we know how bookers are.
Right. I mean, you performed in front of 500 people the weekend. 6 people complained. Not a bad ratio.
Look, I was on a cruise ship and got a stand ovation in a theater that holds 900 seats. And the booker, my booker in New York got back to him that I offended somebody by saying a guy's shirt looks like a Puerto Rican couch. And they never talked about the stand ovation. You know, just one guy, old white lady was upset that I said another guy that she didn't even know.
Well, here's how I would turn it. I go, well, this woman is assuming that I think Puerto Rican couches are ugly. I might be saying that's the nicest shirt in the world. She's the racist. That's how you turn that shit around.
Yeah, that's hilarious and true. That's
because by saying it looks like a Puerto Rican couch.
Well,
and
Patricia's
leaving,
Puerto Rican, by the way. So
girl, that makes it
my
right?
Girl, no, my girl's Puerto Rican. I mean, she's not offended
but
by
she's
it.
Not a couch.
No, she's not a coward. She wouldn't be my girl if she was.
So you feel like, and Joe and I have talked about this a lot, you feel it's the political correctness that has really changed what we do.
Oh, yes, because
which is
up
weird.
Until recently, I mean, Jay Leno made a living on Clinton, you know?
Right.
But could he do that to Trump today and really, I mean, even
yeah,
the talk show guys.
Stephen Colbert does.
But he's not Jay Leno.
He's doing okay.
He's doing okay. I'm just saying.
He's doing really well.
Different format, though. I mean, the Tonight Show, you know. I mean, Fallon could never do
Leno did. The audience has to process this. They know from this show and if they've seen my act, I say terrible things.
Yes.
That's built into it. You're a prop act who juggles and has chainsaws and scarves are fucking offensive. People need to process that's where we are. That's where we are.
That's where we are, man. Just,
that is really disturbing.
It is very disturbing.
And what John said with the bring home the bacon.
Yeah.
I mean, really, is that what we're worrying about?
This all started with McDonald's and the coffee thing, man. Remember
with the
hot chocolate? Remember the hot chocolate spilled on a lady?
The coffee.
And
burned her lap.
And she got burnt, and then she sued for millions?
Yeah, yeah.
We went downhill from there. That opened up the whole can of worms of this whole thing, I think. I think it never ended from there. It just got worse, you know, the whole political correctness thing. So I think comedy is in a bad place right now. I think comedians can't be comedians.
That's fucking scary.
It's scary because we make our living at this. And,
right.
I mean, it's just.
But like I know. I'm taking chances, and there's nights where I say to myself, "Go, fuck it, I'm not going to talk about this tonight. We're just going to give them the easy, happy, crappy show, not cause any waves, get the hell out of here." That's me. Go, you've seen my act. You know I talk about some shit.
Right.
But for a guy like you,
right?
I mean, you said it yourself. You're a crowd pleaser. For you to have to now analyze stupid shit like juggling scarves.
But here's the thing: maybe 20 years ago, there were political comedians, guys who said, "I'm a political comic."
Right, you know? And they were embraced. They were supported. You can't do that now.
You go to their,
unless
go to
you're
their
Dennis
show.
Miller or Bill Maher or John Stewart, and they're already names because they made their
names
from 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't. Like, I walk into so many clubs, and they go, yeah, don't do political stuff. Yeah, comics do political stuff. People walk out, and I go, don't worry, I know what I'm doing. And then I do it, and the vast majority of the time, nobody walks out and I get away with it. Or even if they're uncomfortable, we get through it together because I call the audience. I know we're going
to talk. People spend a lot of money to see Wanda Sykes. Her tickets aren't cheap. And people walk out on her because she bashes Trump. She gets in his ass.
But I don't think they expect that from Wanda Sykes. She's had so much TV exposure where she's the sassy, nice black lady. Right. I don't think they expect her to get all into Trump's ass.
Well,
I think
she's black, for starters.
I understand that.
She's a gay woman.
I understand
so
that.
So she has a lot of reasons.
But you know her.
Yes.
I think people just see her on their characters. She's this lovable, sassy black
woman. Yeah, with the cool voice.
Yeah, that's what she's always... She's been in cartoons.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what she's known as. So they're not expecting her. Whereas if they still saw Bill Maher, well, shame on them.
Yes.
You know, because you know Bill Maher's going to try.
Yeah.
So,
how do you spend $100 to go see somebody you don't know what they do?
People are idiots.
That's like me paying $100 to go see Kiss and I never heard any of their records, you know?
It's probably better that way.
I'm just coming off the chair. That's funny.
What's been your greatest accomplishment as a comedian thus far?
My greatest accomplishment as a comedian is my family seeing me on national television.
Oh, that's nice.
You know, I mean, I've been on a lot of national television shows, you know. And as a kid, when you tell your mom you're going to grow up and be famous, and nobody thinks you're going to grow up and be famous, and I'm not famous, but you know what I'm saying. Nobody thinks you're going to get to the level where you're performing on national television. And so when you grow up...
That's an accomplishment,
man. And you're on national... Yeah, there's millions, thousands of comedians.
Like, here's the thing.
And I'm on national TV.
Like, here's the thing. A TV doesn't really mean anything to me, but I know it means things to the industry and to other people. Like, to me... It's just something we do. I don't have enough of it.
I was at a mall and with my mom, and we were in a store, and I hear this I guess it was a mother-daughter, debating if I was the guy.
Well, that's nice.
You know, they were like, and I can hear the girl going, it is him.
That's great.
You know, and she goes, no, it's not him. And they go, it is him. And they're going back and forth. And I finally said, yeah, it's me. You know.
That's fantastic.
And I got recognized, and I ended up signing an autograph for my mom. Those moments right there, man.
I had something not quite as cool but similar a couple years ago. I'm working in Atlantis, and I'm online for one of the water slides. I got my wife, my little girl with me, and somebody comes up to me and remembers me from a show I did in Maryland.
Nice.
I totally get that.
Yeah, so that's a beautiful thing, man. And that, I mean, when you get recognized in front of your family, man, it is a very rewarding thing.
I get recognized for shit like I saw myself on last night on TV, American Greed, which is not a credit I can use as a comic.
Well, first of all, that's my number one. That's my favorite show of all my shows.
I watch
Forensic Files and American Greed are my favorite shows, man. And last night, I said, Patricia, American Greed's on. Cut it on for me. She flips it over. And we're watching. It's on, you know, running back-to-back episodes. And I was listening at some point. We were eating. And she goes, that looks like Davin. Then she goes, it is Davin. So she grabs the remote control and rewinds it. I go, it is Davin. And I see Joe sitting there.
Were you surprised to see my fat face on that show?
You were very fat face. I was like, Davin gained a lot of weight.
Dude, it looked like I ate myself.
I actually took pictures. I took pictures with my cell phone. We paused it. I took pictures with my cell phone. I couldn't believe how fat your face was.
The camera does add some weight.
They say that.
But they took pictures. I had stills. I got them on my phone. And I did not post any of them.
Wow.
Because I was so – this is before I started my working out. So this was probably April of last year when they start – when they film that. And then I went to Cuba. And then after Cuba, I'm like, I got to change my life. Does my face look as fat?
No. I walked in and – well, that's the first thing I looked at you when I saw you. When I walked in, I was like, he's not fat, fucker. You look huge last night on the
dude. It's insane, right?
Gene Triffalo. You're huge.
I talk about it on the show. I go, it looks like I ate myself. It was
so weird. That... TV does put some pounds on you. They say 5 pounds.
I thought I heard 15, but whatever the hell
it
was,
I think it's five.
Yeah. I was fatter there
last
than
night. That put 15 pounds on you for sure.
God damn.
But
I don't look like that now.
And then I was pissed. I thought, hey, that's my favorite show. Why can't you invite me for that episode?
Well, I'd invite you.
No, I'm just kidding.
They were doing a whole thing with scammers. But yeah, I mean, it's cool. And I saw it last night. Like, I never said, I wasn't looking for it. I'm clicking. I go, oh, there I am.
Okay. You said you're clicking. That was funny. One click.
No, because I was watching CNN.
Right.
And it was on CNBC. So CNN is 25.
Over, yeah.
CNBC is channel 24.
Yeah.
So that's why I went, oh, there I am. I was probably looking for Shark Tank.
Well, I watch American Greed every time it's on television. I try to catch it.
I can give you an autograph.
Thank you very much.
So signing an autograph in front of your mom, because
would perhaps be, I think, one of the highlights of my
That's a good highlight, though.
And then meeting some of the celebrities and stuff like that that I've met over the years. And I like meeting celebrities, you know. People, you know, my mom's come to my shows. My mom was in the audience in Washington, D.C. when I opened up for Gladys Knight, you know.
That's cool.
And, you know, I mean, Gladys Knight, you know.
That's
my
a legend.
Mom's in the front row.
Nice.
And her son comes out in a big theater, and I crush it. Mm-hmm. And then Gladys comes out and does what she does, and she's legendary. And then my mom's backstage with me, meeting Gladys Knight, and we're all taking pictures like this, you know.
So it's a lot about family for you.
Yeah, it's about family. You know, I always wanted to make the family proud, you know, and stuff like that. And they are. They're very proud of me.
What would you change about your career, if anything?
Oh, man, that's a good question, man. Absolutely nothing.
Nothing?
You know what? I have no regrets, dude. I mean, I am who I am. I love my act. I love performing my act.
Mm-hmm. So you never go, for instance, I should have become a monologist. I'd probably be a lot more famous.
I don't think so. I think everything, I don't know if I would be good at it, you know? I'm not saying, I think my calling was my calling. I started out doing card tricks and magic tricks and then kind of got over into the comedy thing. Mm-hmm. I think timing's everything. I always think that I should I should have moved to L.A. and stayed in L.A. I moved to L.A., but I didn't stay out there. After my divorce, I came back to D.C.
Tried to get into the comedy store?
I was in the comedy store.
Okay.
I was a comedy store.
Were you in the big room?
I was in the big room. That's how I got the warm-up. I was a warm-up back for In the House.
What's In the House?
With LL Cool J and Debbie Allen.
Oh, okay.
The TV show, In the House. You never seen that show?
No. I like L.A., but not – I mean L.L., but not that much.
Okay. You know who Debbie Allen is, correct?
No.
No?
I know who Debbie Reynolds was.
Well, Debbie Allen is Felicia Rashad's sister from, and that was.
I know Felicia Rashad is.
Well, her sister is Debbie Allen.
Listen, there's only
the show Fame.
Yeah, but I never watched
it. Okay, she was a star of that show.
There's only so many black people I can keep track of. You know, there's a limit, Kevin.
Okay, so
I got to keep track of all the Jews. All
right, so In the House is, I guess, not as popular as Will Smith's show, but sort of the same thing.
Okay,
you know, I was a warm up guy for that show.
Okay,
out in L.A., I got that gig. For you know, somebody saw me.
So you knew Mitzi Shore and
I knew Mitzi Shore. I knew Dice Clay. I knew everybody.
So if you could do it again, you would have stayed out there.
I'd have stayed out there because I think I lost out on some of the TV stuff by coming back to the East Coast. Of course, you know,
right.
Some of my friends ended up in movies and stuff like that and on television. You know, mm-hmm. I just watched last week Pierre Edwards, who's a friend of mine. He was in the movie Baps, and he has a love scene with Halle Berry, you know.
Oh.
And I'm going to hear a guy that I started in comedy with is doing love scenes with Halle Berry, you know.
Yeah, but who wants that?
But he moved to L.A.
But who wants that?
Nobody.
Nobody.
But he moved to L.A., and he stayed out there, you know.
You never know. I get that.
So, yeah, it was about me.
But you would not have met your girlfriend.
Well, actually, that's not true.
Really?
Patricia and I met actually in 1986, I believe, at Bananas.
But that's an East Coast club.
But I went to L.A. after that.
Okay.
We were an item then. I left her and moved to L.A.
Oh.
And we were trying to do the pen pal thing, which we wrote letters back and forth to each other. Yes. And then that stopped. We lost contact.
So you were sending Dick Polaroids back in the
getting,
day.
Yeah. Dick Polaroids. I think Polaroids were around then, yeah.
So Polaroids were around
then. We lost contact, basically. We stopped after a while. You know, it was like a month of sending letters and, you know, we lost contact. She got married. I got married. She got divorced. I got divorced. We had kids. Facebook brought us back together.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
All right. So when I have comedians on, I like to ask them what their worst hell gig was. Do you have a good hell gig story?
Oh, but of course.
Let me play the
button. Welcome to Hell Gigs.
All right, what's your hell gig story?
Man, well, I've been in business for 35 years. I probably can be here all night telling hell gigs.
Just give me your worst one.
I'll do a recent one that was really bad.
Doesn't have to be recent. Doesn't have to be far away. Just want a good one.
Last December, actually, I get booked to perform at a golf, country club out in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I get there, and I walk in. You know what I do. And I walk in, and I see the stage. I said, oh, great. Nice stage. Nice setup. Cool. And I see a dance floor.
That's never good for a comic.
And I said, okay, great. They're going to put the tables here. And
you thought they were going to be all around you?
I thought they could put the tables on the dance floor by the stage.
Oh, did you? Was this? Are you new?
So.
Did you really think they were going
to
do that?
The guy comes up to me.
Oh, Kevin.
And I'm not even exaggerating. When I say on the other side of the room of this big, giant ballroom, there were tables and people eating.
Yeah, that's the way they do it.
He said, that's your audience. I go, they're not going to move tables here? He goes, no, they're not. I go, well, he goes, they can hear you. That's what he says to me. I go, but he goes, they can see you too. I mean, I can't even.
Did you have the option of performing on the dance floor?
Even the dance floor was far away from the tables. Right. So I went to the dance floor, but I still was way too far away from the audience.
We talked about this on the show. Comedy needs intimacy. Even somebody who's a spectacle like yourself,
yes.
You still need that. Everybody needs to be tied in together.
Even when guys like us perform, and like I said, I opened for Wanda Sykes and opened for Gladys Knight, and I perform in these big theaters.
There's still people in the front row.
There's still people in the front row, you know, and laughter's contagious.
Right.
So it generates through the whole, everybody in the back of the theater is laughing because everybody up front's laughing.
Right. You don't have to send your jokes over a sea of nothing.
Yeah. So this basically was a sea. It was the worst. And I was booked. It was a good paying gig. It was
it's always the good paying ones that hurt the most.
It was a Christmas corporate gig, and it paid pretty well. And here I am. I have to do an hour. And I have to do an hour because the gig.
Oh, that's a long time.
Well, you know, one man shows are normally an hour.
Yeah, but when I get those Christmas parties, I try to talk them down because I know it's just too long to hold their attention. They want to talk with each other. They're drinking and everything. An hour is too much.
And this is at a country club, a very upscale country club.
You should have brought somebody with you. Paid them a couple hundred bucks.
What was the Omnipop gig? But it was an upscale gig, and upscale country club, I should say. And you can just tell by going in there; it's a beautiful place, you know. I don't know what the hell I found palm trees and put it in New York, but it was palm trees when you drive in, you know. I guess they had them shipped in and put in. It's beautiful, you know. And the venue was just awesome. But you walk in and there's like the stage here and the audience was, oh my God, so far away. I've never seen anything like it before in my life. I was like, you want me to perform for these people way over there eating? And he goes, they can hear you. And I had to do an hour. I basically was talking to myself.
Yeah, because
for an hour, I had to talk to myself.
There's a lot, but your act has a lot of crowd work too.
Exactly.
So, are you even trying to do that?
I got to a point where I was just trying to make sure I did my hour so I can get my check.
That's a long time.
Oh, it was a long time of me suffering. It was perhaps one of the worst.
Were they paying attention?
A few people were.
So how many people were there?
There was probably about maybe 150 people.
150 people. What about 15 people paying attention?
I think maybe 10.
10 people paying attention.
I actually had a guy come up to me and shake my hand and says, good job. Yeah. And I was like, boy, you have no idea. I mean,
probably appreciate the situation.
It was, I think they don't understand that, you know, if they were sitting on a dance floor.
They don't know.
The show they would have got would have blew them away.
Right. But yeah. But I mean, we've talked about before, a lot of these hell gigs start with a bad setup. You were dealt a bad setup. Now, it's not really your fault, but most people, they don't give a shit that it's not your fault. They just know that you didn't do what they expected you to do.
And one more. I had somebody throw a drink on me once. Speaking of picking on people, there was an interracial couple in the front row, and I'm giving them crap. I kept calling the guy O.J. Simpson.
Oh.
And he was fine with it. The brother was fine with it. He was laughing and everything. The audience was laughing.
Yeah, because the black guy winds up being alive at the end of this.
Well, yeah. The girl was not happy.
No.
She was not happy about it. And she stood up in the middle of my set and took her beer that was full and threw it right on me. Oof. Yeah. She was escorted out of the club. This happened at Kazi's in Newport News.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I got in trouble for the N-word there. I told you that. Well,
I got called the N-word there on a separate gig.
No, I told you
but
that.
No, you didn't tell me that. But I didn't consider that a hell gig. A lady, a drunk guy.
No, it's not a hell gig.
No.
So, this is years ago. Before I knew you, I had a joke about DMX.
Okay.
And it was a smart joke. But in the joke, be like DMX going, where my niggas at? Where my niggas at? So that's the black part of the
okay.
joke. It was always a smart joke. Always an applause break. Black people applauded. It was always a good joke. Did it Friday night? Not an issue. Did it first show Saturday night? They did not like it. They did not like the white Jewish boy saying nigga, not nigger, saying nigga. So a fat white woman in her 40s, I think with a black boyfriend or husband, waddles her way up to the owner of Kazi's and complains. And so they didn't want me doing that joke anymore. So I had a terrible set. The set was so bad, and I've talked about on the air, Eric McMahon was the headliner. I'm walking past him. He goes, nice try. So I did the second show Saturday night, completely different set, completely different half hour. Didn't do that joke at all. And Eric, and it was much better than Erico's nice bounce back set. But yeah, that, it's kind of interesting how we both had a weird racial experience. Yeah.
Well, I was on stage. Richard Pryor just passed away a few months prior to me being there at Kazi's, and I had on a T-shirt that had Richard Pryor on it.
Right.
And I'm in the middle of my set. You know, I'm doing probably an hour on stage, 45 minutes to my set. Some drunk white guy in the front go, "Who's that nigger on your shirt?"
Good God.
Yeah. Nice and loud for everybody to hear.
You don't know what to do with that stuff. Sometimes
it's
just so startling.
It was, I mean, at that point, because Richard Pryor's on my shirt, of all people, you know.
It's a famous nigger who actually uses the word nigger more than anybody you've ever heard.
That is true. But how do you first of all, not know it's Richard Pryor.
And be a fan of comedy.
And he just passed probably 4 weeks before this gig.
You know the end, because he's ignorant. This person was ignorant.
Well, the alcohol was being real.
You know, it's funny because I used to do that joke, and now I don't do it because I don't want to do it. Just because DMX isn't even relevant anymore.
My career's better than his at this point.
But one of the things that I would get sometimes, not very often, but sometimes I'd get these white guys that would come up to me and felt that because I did that joke, they had license to tell me racist jokes or go, "I really love that nigger joke," and I'd just be like, "No," I'm just thinking to myself. No, you're missing the point of the joke. You're not getting this. But I didn't know what to say.
See, that's something black comics have to deal with a lot is drunk white people coming up to them telling them racist jokes after the show.
Well, I'm sure it's a lot more startling to you than it is to me.
Right.
But I was uncomfortable with it because it was like, no, I'm not using the word to call black people nigger. That you're missing the fucking point.
You're missing the point, right.
That's not even the punchline of the joke. That's DMX's lyrics, and I'm saying, what would I do? The joke is, I'm a white Jewish guy from the suburbs. Where my Heebs at?
Gotcha.
They'll be like, yo, represent, where my Heebs at? Represent the niggas like they're lawyers. That was the fucking joke. I'm joking on my people, because I said that word that they just have to embrace so much for all the fucking wrong reasons, that's all they're focused on. So even though it was a great joke, it was a smart joke, I'm glad I don't have those conversations anymore after shows. I'm glad for the most part people don't feel open enough, chummy enough that I would embrace that type of bigotry.
Even in this day and age, you still think that would be, I mean.
I know it would now. I mean, shit, now people are more emboldened than ever.
Yeah, that is true.
My mom says, and I haven't been using my last name for years for the most part, but my mom says don't use your last name because of all the anti-Semitic crap.
Right.
That's going on. And I had, I don't remember what the joke was, but the only other N-word joke, again, it was nigga.
You have a lot of N-word jokes, Davin.
I had two. I had two. It's true. Was not about Barack Obama, but it was something about like Barack Obama and like how his mother was. I don't remember what the joke was, but it was another smart joke. I don't just use the word gratuitously, and I certainly don't call people, the N-word, whether they be in the audience.
You're a modern day Lenny Bruce. I get it. Okay.
On some level, I mean, certainly not as talented or as successful, but...
Well, don't put yourself down. You may be. I mean, what would Lenny Bruce in today's society be in a ripper room like Davin?
No.
Exactly.
Lenny'd be arrested all the fucking time.
Exactly.
Or he'd have a cabinet position in the Trump administration.
There you go. Most likely it'd be in the Trump administration.
So Kev, what's the name of the book again?
Playing with Fire. It's on Amazon right now. Playing with Fire is a really good book. It has a lot of legs with it. I mean, it talks about everything about, you know...
A lot of sexy talk in there?
Oh, lots of... Don't let your kids read it. We talk a lot about hookers and Playboy models and things like that. I've been very blessed to have some pretty beautiful women in my life. And
Including your fiance now?
Including... That's really the best part of being in show business is getting the beautiful women.
Absolutely.
Yes.
There you go. So check it out. Kevin's going to hang out with us
for
the rest of the show. But definitely check out the book. It's a good read. On the break, we got new music from G-Mac with Christmas Joy and Mick J. Clark with It's Getting Near Christmas. And you can learn more about them on deucemusic.com. On the break, Pip is going to come back, so we'll have Pip for the rest of the show. And people are losing their minds over Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Baby It's Cold Outside. So we'll get into that. Don't go anywhere.